You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the podcast where we're talking about Bitcoin. Today's guest is a longtime friend and fellow Bitcoiner, Bill Miller IV. We've had Bill Miller Sr. on the show numerous times in the past, but never his fellow portfolio manager and son. During our conversation, Bill explains how him and his father first got into Bitcoin in 2013, haven't sold a single coin since, some of his thoughts on the broader markets handling inflation, Bitcoin versus crypto, sage advice that he's learned through the years, and much, much more. So without further delay, here's my chat with Bill Miller.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Like I said in the introduction, I'm here with Bill Miller. Bill, we've been talking for years now, and it is about time we actually had a recorded conversation. So I'm excited to be doing this finally.
Me too, man. That makes two of us. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, it's about time. So let's just start with the overall markets, because there's so much happening right now that, holy moly, I mean, the currencies, let's just start there. So when I'm looking at various currency charts, the DXY, the dollar, is just ripping, absolutely ripping. And it's not like the dollar's ripping and you got all these other currencies that are about halfway through their move. It appears like a lot of these other currencies, the Japanese yen, the yuan, the euro, any major currency appears to be stopping out at whatever previous limitation that we saw against the dollar in previous currency cycles. And I guess for me, when I'm looking at this and I'm looking at the Fed getting ready to go into a 50 basis point hike, I'm thinking to myself, how in the world can, in the backdrop of that, like over in Japan, you got them still doing yield curve control, like, how in the world is the market going to be able to handle this moving forward?
So first of all, I'm not a currency expert. Let's start with that. But you know, with the Fed starting to raise rates, and you'd expect, I guess, the dollar to be getting stronger there, right? With everyone else dumping currencies or dumping fuel on the fires in their neighborhoods as well.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting setup, I'd say, macroeconomically here. I mean, if you think about what's going on with rates, what's going on with the housing market, what's going on with inflation and prices. We've seen a 40-year high in inflation, job market's on fire, people can't get enough housing. Now the Fed's starting to raise rates. I mean, you wonder how it's going to resolve, the situation's going to resolve itself when you're looking at, you know, mortgage rates have made a dramatic move here over the past just couple months. I mean, going from all-time lows at 2 and change now to 5. That's a big change. I mean, that's some unique interest rate or mortgage rate volatility that people hadn't seen before. But at the same time, housing prices are going up at 19% a year, and you're financing that asset at 5%. So, you know, interestingly enough, the home builders ETF is off year to date a good amount. But, you know, demand for housing is going to continue. It's just part of the problem is people can't get the supplies to build stuff, you know, because of often talked about supply chain constraints. You can't get stuff. And so that's slowing stuff down because inflation's been, the Fed is so far behind the curve right now. It's interesting because the Fed was behind the curve, I think, the entire past decade. And it seems like, and they came to a mea culpa actually a couple of years ago when the San Francisco Fed came out and said, look, you know, we told you 2% was a symmetrical target. Well, we actually went back and looked at our own meetings with a computer and analyze the verbiage used. And it turns out that we were actually thinking about 2% as a ceiling, right? And so, which was interesting because then you have all these capital allocators, CFOs and stuff going, putting funds into the market going, okay, here, 2% should be a sort of symmetrical target. In reality, it was a ceiling. So they were too tight on the other end, which never allowed us to get to escape velocity, right? And now we're well beyond escape velocity and interest rates are still pretty much at zero. And inflation's at 8. So, you know, the Fed has a very hard job. It's super hard. But if I'm in the Fed seat right now, I'm going to come out of the next meeting and hike more than 2 hikes here, right? Because the market's expecting 2 hikes and acceleration and inflation expectations are accelerated. So they got to get ahead of that and come out and do something like a, you know, maybe you come out and do, you know, 62.5 basis points hike instead of 50. Just let the market know, you know, you're ahead of things. If you're actually afraid of being too fast, I think that, you know, you can't rock the boat too much, but you got to get ahead of stuff at this point.
That's funny you say that, because Greg Foss said something to me probably 2 days ago. He was like, I think it's going to be 75. And nobody in the market's saying that. Most people right now, the consensus is it's 50 basis points. But
I think Bullard came out maybe one day in last week and said, it's not my base case, but 75 is a possibility. And they were kind of testing waters with that one, but who knows?
I guess the thing that I'm really struggling with is, I agree with that when you're looking at it just from like the US lens and how much inflation we have here, how far from the rest of the curve they are with the federal funds rate. But at the same time, I'm looking internationally and I'm looking at how all these other currencies are, they look like they're at a point that historically that trend line is suggesting that something breaks at this point. And they're still at 25 basis points. They, like you said, they basically haven't moved at all, right? They haven't moved at all. And the rest of the world is getting ready to break. I think when you look, China alone, I mean, look at China, the videos and stuff I'm seeing coming out of there. It's just, it's asinine.
I don't know what's going on over there. It's pretty scary, actually.
I was trying to figure it out on Twitter over the weekend. And it was interesting. People really sent me, you know, a wide array of different thoughts on it. And it, you know, it was a mix from people saying, oh, it's a strategic play, to people saying, no, there's internal fighting within the CCP. And some of this has to do with just the resourcing that they have for food and water and whatnot. And you're seeing an infighting between Shanghai and Beijing. I mean, one thing's for sure, the videos are strange, like very strange coming out of there. And I wonder how much of it's just the stuff we just really can't even understand from a resourcing standpoint. But yeah, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with this next hike and then kind of how the fixed income market behaves from there. I'm seeing a growing chorus of people suggesting that we're seeing the long end of the curve kind of peak out right now. And we actually might start to see it get bid because they're trying to front run the big deflationary fit that's on the horizon. Do you buy that, or you think there's still more to sell off here based on the negative spread to the inflation numbers that we've seen printed?
I mean, I think if you just look historically, when you're at this level of negative real rates, just the reflexivity of demand is going to be interesting. I think it's going to continue to be robust. With that said, if you get too much whipsawing volatility, it can throw off people's planning. And I think the Fed knows that. And I think they're ahead of that. And I think the Fed knows that when the curve inverts, the bond market's predicting a recession, right? They know that now.
Yeah.
And they're watching that. They're watching their, you know, 5-year forward indicator as well. It's the five-year forward, right? They keep a good look at that. That's now accelerated out too to two, I think it's like 260-ish now, which tells you they're kind of, I think, behind the curve again. So there's all kinds of things that are accelerating and changing that are saying, okay, time to get ahead of this and shut it down. But so there are things that are breaking. And I think that's why you continue to see this crazy volatility in all kinds of markets that are out there. But when I say breaking, I don't mean in a systemic sense necessarily, because it's everyone's incentive to keep the thing together, right? And to keep everything moving along. And so history has shown that's generally what happens. And so, you know, it's from an investment perspective, at least, it's hard to sit here and say, I got to go to cash, or I got to go to, you know, all bonds or whatever, because I think a recession is on the horizon. It's a very low probability event. And the great quote on that one is, more money is lost preparing for recessions in the market than ever is actually lost in the recession itself, or, you know, the bear market drawdown or whatever. But yeah, so it's not, and I wouldn't say it's impacting like our positioning or the way we think about the world broadly, because we tend to bet broadly on growth and optimism and things working out.
Well, yeah, no, and I like that take. Somewhere there's a bull market. You got to just kind of be able to look around and see where that might be. You know, when I'm thinking of one of the boldest calls that you and your dad have made through the years, I think we all know what that is. I'm curious if you're willing to kind of maybe share some of the the impetus and when you guys first kind of went into this trade. And I think it was back in 2015 was when you guys first
2013.
Wow. Okay. 2013.
And we, hey, Preston, let's not call it a trade. Okay. It's not a trade. We've been consistent buyers since 2013.
Thank you for correcting that. And
what, I have, what I am personally doing? Have never sold a Bitcoin
button. What am I doing calling it a trade? 2013. So everything that I've seen published is 2015. I did not realize you guys were in that early. Walk us through it. So, I mean, you guys would have seen and you guys would have had this opinion that the 2008 crisis was not solved. I'm assuming that was some of the impetus for the position. Walk us through it. What were you guys thinking?
So it may be more simple now, but by the way, I do, my dad's probably not watching this show right now, but I'll come out here and say this, that I actually want to go on the record and compare. I don't know if we can do this on the blockchain or via our original, wherever we originally bought Bitcoin. I want to go back and see who bought Bitcoin earlier, me or him. He obviously has way more than I do and has done way better in it. But I just want to go back and I do want to go back and take a look at that. But the impetus for it was, for me at least, was just repeatedly seeing this thing pop up in the newspapers and this crazy, interesting idea that was just this wacky thing and it had gone up a gajillion percent, but it was really volatile and blah, 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 blah. And so then, you know, they talk about the white paper and go, okay, I got to take a look at that. Go read that. You go, wow. This is pretty cool. This is really interesting. This is actually a unique idea. It's a new technology no one's ever seen before. And then it allows people to transact and exchange value with no central party or processor. It can't be censored. Wow. The supply is known ahead of time. Everyone knows the rules. This could have some really interesting, you know, potential. And so started buying it then and followed it ever since. And it's the way it's scaled, the technology is just so cool. And so we've been, you know, actively interested in it and trying to let people know as broadly as we can about it. And it's been a really cool asset for us.
You know, whenever I first got into it, the big thing that was concerning, if you will, for its future was really kind of the scaling. How are we ever going to get to a point where we can do immediate settlement and have the bandwidth to go beyond, call it 400,000 transactions, you know, per block or per minute. I forget what the number was, but how do we get to something that was comparable to Visa or MasterCard to handle the throughput? And, you know, back then in 2015, there was ideas on what that might be, but there was no solution that seemed like there was that was coming around anytime soon. So how did you guys think through that risk? And what, you know, how to size the position back then?
How to think through the scalability risk? Well, so there, you know, there's actually different use cases for it, right? In that the transaction aspect of it doesn't need to occur necessarily for the idea to have value, right? And that you can have this digital ledger where you can store your own means personally. You don't need to necessarily be able to be using it every single day. And as a matter of fact, why would you want to spend something that goes up 200% a year, right? Yeah. So like, I don't know. And that's part of the knock against it is that they're one of the many bear cases that have prevented people from making a lot of money so far over the past 12 years. People say, you know, you can't, it's too volatile, right? You don't know what it's worth. Well, by the time it's no longer volatile, it'll be $1 million plus a Bitcoin. And so if you just look at it on a mean variance, you know, portfolio theorem, traditional risk return basis, if you add it to any portfolio, it would have made that portfolio much, much better on sort of the traditional financial metrics that people have cared about over time. But again, you don't need the transaction aspect to it. And I don't know if we necessarily saw that these additional layers would be built on top. You know, what, like Lightning Network, that sort of thing. But we saw the certainly the case for the value storage and the fact that the value couldn't be inflated away. And that's not a concern in the US, it's a concern in countries, or hasn't been at least in the past. But, you know, now in other countries, that is a huge benefit to it, is that, you know, you can do remittances in a currency, it's something that is appreciated over time as opposed to lost purchasing power. And so there's all kinds of unique aspects to it that are really cool and different.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host two live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
Talk to us about the idea of not selling your winners. I think this is something that you and your dad have just, you know, when I think about what your dad especially is known for, is really kind of this idea of not selling your winners. I know he's pretty famous for the whole Amazon, just owning that and not taking it out of his portfolio or reducing his size. He just lets it ride. So talk to us about this idea and why this is so important for successful investing.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple of things you want to do to be successful in investing. One of them is minimize your liabilities. And so anytime you sell a heavily appreciated asset, really the only thing you know for sure when you sell that heavily appreciated asset is you just create a liability for yourself. And so even if you have a heavily appreciated asset, the total addressable market is still huge. So it could still grow, assuming its valuation isn't crazy, you know, relative to its potential longer term. Even if you're going to compound at a below market rate, it may actually be rational to hold on to that just because if you look at the after-tax return, it's going to make sense. And so, but if you can find something that has a massive addressable market with a phenomenal management team that can keep attacking it and just growing and building upon their scale and their moats, then you never want to sell that. And so, you know, watching him and his personal accounts been pretty cool too. I mean, I've learned a lot from working with him, but you know, one of the things I've learned is watching him manage his own money, and he'll finance stuff with margin debt regularly. So, you know, just because you don't have to create the liability, the margin debt costs a couple percent a year and his confidence is going to grow faster than that. Not that I'm sitting here recommending people use margin debt, because I think it requires a very thoughtful framework and approach to managing it and knowing the rules to it, which he obviously does and has done very well. But yeah, not and minimizing that tax liability is actually a very important thing that, you know, not enough people do. And, you know, one of the great books on investing is, I have it somewhere around here, it's just the old Jesse Livermore.
Oh, yeah.
Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. One of the points he makes in it is all the money he made was in sitting, not in trading, right? Yeah. The big money is made in the big moves. And that was one of my dad's inspirations for the approach.
You know, it's funny. I read that book after talking to your dad and him saying something very similar to me years ago about figure out what the big move is. And then once you get there, stay as long as you can, stay as long as you think that there's, like you're saying, an addressable market that can keep letting it run. And that's how you really make a lot of money in some of these positions. Awesome, awesome feedback there. So Bill, let's change gears. Let's talk about the recent news here with Twitter and Elon Musk. What are some of your thoughts on this? So we just found out today that the buy is going to go through. What are some of your thoughts around this one?
Man, I could not be happier. I think this is such a win for humanity. I saw Senator Warren tweeted that said this is dangerous. I thought, dangerous that the most successful entrepreneur in the history of the world is going to allow free speech on the town square for the world. What is the problem? I mean, this is fantastic. This is so good. You know, it's going to be cool. So we'll see what happens. But I'm very excited about it.
I'm excited about the news and I'm remaining skeptical on the application of everything that he says he's going to do. I suspect that he's going to open things up and we are not going to have this crazy censorship that is so obvious, so insanely obvious on just so many different fronts. And man, I'm here for that. If that's what is put in place, and I'm definitely here for the bots, these reply bots. Oh my God. Have you seen some of Michael Saylor's thoughts on implementing basically, you know, like an orange verification badge for people that load Bitcoin into some type of escrow? And then I think this is such a brilliant idea and something that is so needed. You have to have some type of feedback mechanism that just prevents the spamming. I mean, my Lord. Any other comments or things on that?
I'm excited. Anything Michael Saylor says, I am a big fan of. So
brilliant.
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 Bitcoin versus crypto. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do have some thoughts on this, actually. I don't own any quote unquote crypto. I think B3 owns some Ethereum. I think maybe through liquid traded vehicles, less so than owning it direct. But yeah, I just think that I think there's one. I think there's one that stands above the rest. It's Bitcoin. I think when you look at the just theoretical underpinnings of it, the way it was constructed, the fact that there is no central person or set of people tied to it, I think that is just a massive, unique underlying attribute that's important to think about. And when you look at the verification, let's call it consensus mechanism here for processing new blocks, proof of work is important, I think, in that the base layer should be hard to create. It should take time. It should take energy. And the process has been set underway and it just seems unstoppable at this point when you think about just the overall security around it and feedback loops and all kinds of other stuff. It was really, I'd say, a stroke of genius for Satoshi. So it's pretty cool. But, you know, when you think about crypto and DeFi and the other stuff going on there, that obviously has a lot of potential. In some ways, I'm not sure that we're probably beyond the point of them being ruled illegal securities offering some of these other things, but you never know, right? And that's already been ruled out, I think, for Bitcoin, which is one of the reasons I think why institutions are increasingly buying it, putting on their balance sheet. A lot of it's been de-risked from that perspective, from the scaling perspective, from the technology, proving the concept. But, you know, a lot of people say, hey, invest in my crypto thing. And my take is, why wouldn't I just buy Coinbase stock? Right? Because, I mean, or that should be their benchmark, quite candidly, if you want to talk about establishing a benchmark for a crypto thing, should be Coinbase stock. You know, Coinbase stock, they are the 800-pound gorilla. They sit in the middle of it all. They have a ventures arm where you get access to all these other currencies, right? You don't have to deal with some new setup. Most people probably have a stock account. Could it fail? Sure. I think it's unlikely. I think it's increasingly unlikely at this point when you look at the evolution of the ecosystem. But Coinbase is probably the place you want to be if you want to be in quote unquote crypto and have exposure to that whole, to the entire ecosphere. And so it's not an expensive stock. I don't think at this point we think about the long-term prospects of what's going on there. And that's probably the best way to get exposure to it. Real easy way for people to get exposure to it, I'd say, long-term.
I liked your point about there needs to be some type of work or some type of energy commit to a base layer of this entire ecosystem. Because without that, I don't know how we're really saying we're solving anything compared to the existing system and quandary that we're in. And I think it's important that, you know, at the end of the day, opinions are opinions, but there needs to be some type of incentive that actually drives that to be the outcome. And when I look at the whole mining process and I look at a lot of Michael Saylor's points about these reinforcing network effects that just naturally occur around proof of work, I suspect, and I think I'm very biased in this, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I suspect that that is one of the reasons why Bitcoin is going to be paramount over all these other competing protocols is because those reinforcing network effects are around energy. And we're seeing this with the energy companies starting to really, I think their eyes are really starting to be opened up as to how this is going to assist them into handling additional energy production. And they've got these requirements for peak energy versus, you know, their standard steady state energy demand, that so much of this is going to be reinforcing to Bitcoin. Is that what you're seeing as well? Or is there something else that maybe you're looking at?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, Bitcoin solves a lot of problems. And one of them is it helps eliminate waste in that current system. And so it's really interesting to see some of the innovations that are occurring in the mining space, people using all kinds of unique energy sources that had either gone to waste before or had just not been properly utilized. You know, Exxon's flaring gas to mine Bitcoin now. It's just crazy to see the extent of innovation, you know, going on around it. And so that's super exciting. There's less, obviously, attention and innovation, I'd say, around the overall process to this other stuff, to a lot of these other coins, for obvious reasons, because they have different consensus mechanisms, I'd say. Less robust consensus mechanisms, I would say. But it's super interesting to see all of the innovation going on, not only in the financial aspects, but in the energy, you know, Bitcoin mining side of things too.
Talk to us about, here's another thing that I find interesting about you and your dad, is this idea of concentrated investing. You hear some really greats through the decades that talk about this idea where, and I think Buffett has a pretty famous quote of saying that you have a pretty small amount of eggs that are in the basket, and then you watch that basket really closely. What are some of your thoughts around this idea of concentrated investing that you'd like to tell people?
Yeah, I think that's how, you know, massive amounts of wealth is made, is through concentration. It's not through diversifying into different asset classes that'll do 8% or, you know, 8% with some level of specified volatility and, you know, put all kinds of constraints around what could happen. But at the same time, you know, concentration does come with risk. But if you can find something at a very small size that could grow, that has a great management team, again, that you can talk about all these characteristics, potential for high returns on capital, eventual moat, you know, natural monopoly type characteristics, anything like that, and you want to ride that as far as you can, nope. So long as you're not going to be left in a position where if it goes, you know, back to some other, if it collapses or something doesn't go your way, you're not going to be broke or something. But concentrated investing is, if you look at actually the market and the history of the market, it's actually a very small number of stocks that drive the overwhelming amount of returns in the market. And the overwhelming number of stocks in the market at any given time underperform the index they're in over their lifetime, that index. So, you know, you want, if you get concentrated and you buy, you know, most of the things you buy are probably not going to do very well. So if you got to find the stuff that makes sense, but if you find it, you want to stick with it for sure.
You know, when you go to college and you study, you know, finance or you get an MBA, they throw around the term risk And it's almost like there's an equal sign to volatility. And like, that's just it. Like, that's just the law. Risk equals volatility. I tend to think that when I hear the word risk and volatility, I think that's for a money manager. That's for somebody who's managing somebody else's money, who is entrusting them to do smart things with it. And they're risking losing that person as a client because there's too much volatility in their portfolio. When I think about like the volatility in a, when I think about the risk in a company, it's the competitive moat, like you had said, right? That's the thing that like, is there going to be impairment to the underlying assets that sit on that company's balance sheet? That's the risk to the business and the risk to maybe their market premium and whether they're going to continue to have free cash flows into the future and all that kind of stuff. So like risk should be based around, you know, a really deep analysis on the underlying assets and how they sit in a competitive environment. But it's almost like that's not even discussed in college. Like why, how in the world does that like not get discussed? It's about volatility and betas and this and that. Like it's just.
Right. Right. Well, things that go up a lot are going to be volatile too, by definition.
By definition, yeah.
So that's important to keep in mind. But if you think about investing, it's an optimization problem. And a lot of these people that want to bucketize things and put things into these unique categories, all they really do is constrain their outcomes. And optimization problems generally do better with fewer constraints, right? And so at the same time, it gives you more opportunity to do something dumb. But the whole mean variance portfolio theorem, I think it misses a lot of, I think there's underlying assumptions about it. And I'm sure academics will tell me I'm wrong on this, but you think about the whole premise there and it's, you got to hit this rate of return because you got to draw down some portion of fund or you need a big portion of it at a given time. If you don't need the money in a year or 2 years, why are you caring about the volatility of that in the short term, right? And so if you can do well on something volatile over the long term, it makes a lot of sense to just sit in it and not think too much about it or try and trade it. As we said earlier, the big money is made in the big moves and in sitting, not in, you know, trying to trade stuff around and create tax liabilities. And then you got to spend time figuring out that, managing your gains and losses. And
let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
And that's a good highlight that you had there as well, which is the, if you know you're going to need whatever amount in a year from now, well, then you have to think about that volatility a whole lot more than if you're buying stuff like Bitcoin and you plan on owning it until the cows come home. You're not trading it.
Not a trade.
I appreciated that correction. I really did. Talk to us about this idea of dematerialization and about institutions, very important institutions through the years, and how so many of them are being dematerialized.
Super interesting. And it's all being driven, I think, by technology and the accessibility of information now. You can get educations online for free. I mean, and just, it's all out there if people want to learn, right? And so at the end of the day, I think schools are becoming more behavioral management organizations rather than, you know, actually needing to provide the education. And if you just think about, let's go to schools. You talked about organizations broadly. Let's touch on schools. I'm a big believer in education. My whole family is a big believer in education. I spent a lot of money and time at good schools, did post-school education through CFA, CMT. Got to learn every day in what we do. So I'm a big believer in it. I just think that when you kind of look at the core role, it's evolving a little bit. And education, the cost of a college education has gone up, I think, at roughly 3 times the rate of CPI over the past like 3 decades. And so that's just, that's not sustainable. And so I think a lot of these schools have become victims in a way of their own success. And what happens is over the years, people will go to these schools and they were centralized locations for learning in times when this kind of information wasn't accessible more broadly on the internet. And so, you know, people will go to these schools to learn and they'd learn a lot of stuff. And they'd, you know, some people would be very successful and earn a lot of money and they'd give it back to the schools, rightly so, because the schools helped them learn what the knowledge that allowed them to generate, you know, fungible means. And so they would give it back to the school. It made a lot of sense. And then that process just continued and continued and continued and still continues today to the point now where a lot of these schools just have such large pools of resources that they don't necessarily need. It attracts certain types of people that don't necessarily care about tangible outcomes in all kinds of different ways, right? And so this then just feeds on itself in a way over time. And interestingly enough, now people can get their educations online if they really want to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these schools are still great filtering, you know, or, you know, sieve mechanisms to get to, if somebody went to a really good school, they probably studied hard and there's some floor on, you know, their IQ or capability set or something, I think. But, you know, it's interesting to see how this evolves. And by the way, this is coming from someone that highly values education. So, but I think right now that one of the implications for an investor is that there's probably going to be a lot of money made in educational pursuits online.
Yeah, the dematerialization of the status quo of learning, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, this is another one of Michael Saylor's big things that he's really working on is like, how do I dematerialize the cost of education? Because I can warp myself through space and time and gain access to some of the best professors on the planet for whatever the subject might be. You know, it's funny. There's this app, it's Dragon something, that my son, who's very young, is there learning algebra. He has no clue how to do algebra. All he knows is when I match this picture or inverse this picture or whatever, he's learning like the rules and the process of algebra. And then they just swapped out the pictures with numbers. And there he is, like, doing algebra. It was somewhat crazy to witness. He doesn't understand why or how, but he's conditioning his brain through these apps. And I think that's just like one small example of so many things you can do in the education space moving forward, and like people paying $250,000 for an education. And it's like, my God, you can learn a majority of this for literally nothing online if you just have the...
If you put your mind to it
and you have the drive and desire, right? All right. Final question here for you. What's up with you and your dad with the firm? Is he retiring soon? Is he kind of slowly, phasing out from doing it? What's going on? Because he hasn't been on the show for a while.
He's trying to pursue his own intellectual pursuits, and he's doing a lot more philanthropic stuff and thinking about that. And he's becoming increasingly less involved in the day-to-day management of the actual funds. He is, I'd say he's still actively involved, but he's not doing as much as he used to. And he's not doing it around the clock like he used to.
Can he hang it up?
No, I think he's always going to be looking for the next big idea for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. So he can't really, he's never really going to hang it up. I totally agree with you on that point.
Does he become more lethal as he's more focused on only a couple things?
Yeah, actually, it's a very good point. It's a massively important point. Focus matters for sure. And, no, he's just looking to turn it over to the next generation. So I'm excited to, actually take in a little bit of a different direction here, just because I think technology is now at a point, and the investment landscape is at a point where you can do some really interesting things and level the field, I would say, for the retail guy, and actually help them understand more what an active investor is doing, why they're doing it. You can see new types of products that have daily transparency, right? So people can actually see what you did yesterday, and maybe you can let them know why you did it yesterday, which you couldn't do for a retail crowd before. The mutual fund thing is shrinking slowly every single year, as the data shows. And I think there's an opportunity to, launch a platform here where you can better help the retail investor think about active investing and where it fits into their portfolio and their financial planning space. And, there's just a ton of really good content out there. I don't know if you read The Psychology of Money.
No, I haven't read that.
I know I have one on this shelf. This book, Morgan Housel, The Psychology of Money.
Okay.
Great, great.
Oh, I'll have to pick
it up. Great book. You have to read that. I'll send you a copy for having me on.
Yeah, I'd love to have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. But that kind of stuff, you can even take that, the contents in that book or the ideas, right? And boil them down and do them in a different, format, and do some pretty cool stuff on the media side of things. So we are actively hiring for people that can help with that kind of thing and produce that content.
Oh, cool. That's awesome. Okay. All right, Bill. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Like I said in the intro there, we should have done this a long time ago, and it's just been a pleasure knowing you and your dad through the years, and it was awesome seeing you down in Florida.
Super cool.
That was really quite interesting. And it was even more interesting that when I bumped into you, I was there with Tur, the Meester.
Yes. Because,
come on. That's just so serendipitous, because I know, probably back in 2017, your dad reached out to me and he's like, hey, do you know Tur? And I was like, yeah, let me introduce you to him. And so those two linked up, and then you and I just happened to bump into each other down in Florida, and there's Tur at the same time. It was just wild, but
so cool.
So neat. It's just crazy.
Yeah. I had a great conversation with Michael that day on all kinds of fascinating Bitcoin topics. It was super cool.
That was the first time I met Michael when we were down there, and having interviewed him, just meeting him in person, like, oh my God, he is beyond smart. Like,
he's awesome.
Just so nice, and just so nice, and just easy to talk to. Just a great guy. But
I learned a ton that day. It was super cool.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Bill. And we'll have links to all your handle on Twitter and also the company and the firm and all of that. Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight before we wrap it up?
No, I had a great time. Thanks for having me on. Let's do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks, Preston. It was great. Thanks again.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show or you learned something new or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.